Great, welcome back. So remember, we defined the set of differential forms, in fact, an algebra. We called it capital lambda of M. And it's an associative algebra called the Grassmann algebra over the manifold. The multiplication in this algebra is given by this wedge product, which consists of taking the tensor product and then anti-symmetrizing. And we defined the exterior derivative, a derivation, on this exterior algebra, on the Grassmann algebra. And the exterior derivative, D, is an antiderivation of degree k equal to 1 of the Grassmann algebra. The fact that it is an antiderivation means that the Leibniz rule has the occasional minus sign in it, depending on the degree of what is being differentiated. And the fact that it is a derivation of degree k equal plus 1 means that an R form is being differentiated to obtain an R plus 1 form. Now, we started out this course by defining tangent vectors as directional derivatives. And the question now is, other than directionally differentiating functions, can we also directionally differentiate differential forms? So we already have the directional derivative of zero forms because it's the directional derivative of functions. That's what the tangent vectors do. But can we use tangent vectors also to differentiate differential forms in an arbitrary direction? And for that, the plan will be this. We define yet another derivation, in fact, an antiderivation, but this time of degree k equal to minus 1. So two forms are differentiated to obtain a one form, a three form is differentiated to obtain a two form. And this will be called the inner derivation, as opposed to the D, which is the exterior derivation. Where is it? Over here. Right, that's the exterior derivation. And then we will combine the exterior and the inner derivations to obtain a derivation of degree k equal to 0. You see, the D is lifting the degree by 1 of a differential form, and the I will lower it. And in this way, we get a derivation of degree k equal to 0, which is what a proper directional derivative should be. Because if you directional differentiate a function, you get another function whose values are the derivatives at that point, right? Are the directional derivatives. And so similarly, the directional derivative of an R form should be an R form. There are two ways to do this. We can do this using the algebraic approach, working with derivations, and that's what we will do first. Or we can do it with the Newton-Leibniz epsilon-delta approach, and we will do that too, second. And as you will see, the algebraic approach is much more convenient because with the epsilon-delta, it's really tedious. And simplicity is important here in mathematics, too, because it enables us to understand things better if they are simpler. But we will see how all of this plays out. So remember, the strategy is we want to get a directional derivative, which will be called the Lie derivative. And we will obtain it by combining the exterior and the inner derivation. So what's the inner derivation? To define the inner derivation, we assume that xi is, again, a directional vector field. So xi is a tangent vector field. And our aim is to define now an antiderivation that we will call I subscript xi, so the inner derivation in the direction of xi, of degree k equal to minus 1. That is to say, we are looking to define a derivation which is a linear map from S forms into S minus 1 forms. That means degrees minus 1. And we will write it in this way. We will say that if omega is an S form, then it's being mapped by the inner derivation into inner derivation of omega. That's a That whole thing is an S minus 1 form. And it is supposed to obey the anti-Leibniz rule, meaning that it's the Leibniz rule in principle. So the derivation of the wedge product is the derivation of the first factor, leaving the second factor the same, plus leaving the first factor the same and wedge derivation of the second factor, except that there are minus signs whenever the degree of the second factor here is odd. Earlier in the course, one of you asked, with this algebraic approach, do we always get something that could alternatively be expressed in terms of a Newton-Leibniz limit? And I said, no, not always. And that's the case where this happens. This derivation that we will now define doesn't have a Newton-Leibniz limit. It's not defined in that way at all. So how do we define this? We say it's supposed to be an antiderivation of degree k minus 1. Having fixed this, we now only need to fix how it acts on zero forms and how it acts on a basis of one forms. And then by linearity and by the Leibniz rule or anti-Leibniz rule, we can infer how it acts on all differential forms. Okay. So how shall it act on zero forms? And then how shall it act on one forms? Well, how shall it act on zero forms? Any ideas? Well, you can read it off, right? It maps zero forms into zero. But it really is no alternative to this, because it's supposed to be a derivation of degree k equal minus 1. But there are, you know, you can't go down from zero forms to minus 1 forms. There is no such thing. So therefore, the only way to go is to map it all into zero. But then, how is it supposed to map? How is it supposed to act? How is the inner derivation supposed to act on one forms? Well, it's going to map one forms into zero forms, but how? So if we apply the inner derivation on a one form, omega is in lambda 1, on this one form, then it's supposed to output a number at every point, or a function on the manifold, right? How do we do that? Well, the simplest thing to do is to evaluate omega on xi, the direction vector, right? So it's just omega of xi. After all, we have only those two things available. To define our inner derivation, we have the direction in which we want to differentiate, and we have the object that needs to be differentiated. There's only one way that we can have them act onto each other. Okay, so that's the evaluation of a cotangent vector on a tangent vector, or vice versa, tangent vector on a cotangent vector. And now it's already done. We've already defined completely what this inner derivation will do on all differential forms by linearity and the anti-Leibniz rule. So I xi is already defined now as a map from all differential forms into all differential forms. Here's a proposition. If gamma is an S form, then the inner derivation acting on that gamma, on this S form, is an S minus 1 form. That's not the proposition. That's obvious because it's a degree minus 1 derivation. But the way it acts is very simple. Namely, this S minus 1 form, I xi of gamma, is the differential form here, which has the following action. You take this differential form, it's supposed to be an S minus 1 form, and therefore, as an S minus 1 form, it has S minus 1 input ports, like a laptop ports, right, where you can plug something in. So it has S minus 1 input slots, right, in which you can put tangent vectors. So if the eta 1 to eta s minus 1 are tangent vectors, we can plug them in there, right? And in order to specify, in order to explain what this inner derivation of gamma in the xi direction does, we can look at what it does to this s minus 1 tangent vectors that are being input into it. And what the proposition says is that the value that you get, it's a number, right? Or over the entire manifold, it's a function, it's a scalar function, because you are taking an s minus 1 form and feeding it s minus 1 tangent vectors, get a number out of it. And what number is that? It's the number that you would get if you take the s form gamma, the undifferentiated s form gamma, and feed into its s input ports the xi as one entry, and then the s minus 1 other tangent vectors. In other words, it's really very simple what the inner derivation does, and it clearly has nothing to do with Newton-Leibniz. Because what it does is it takes an S form and turns it into an S minus 1 form by plugging the xi into the first entry. Right? That's what it does. There's really not anything differentiating going on here. All it does is essentially it's generalizing the idea that you can plug a tangent vector into a cotangent vector. Differential forms are covariant tensors of higher order, and you just plug a tangent vector into one of the entries, the first one in this case.
Professor?
Yeah?
Would it be contracted?
Yes, that's right. It's a contraction then. It's one of the indices. One of the lower indices, you see, a differential form written as a tensor in a basis has lower indices. A tangent vector is a vector with one upper index, and they would be contracted. And then you're left with s minus 1 indices. And those are the indices of the remaining tensor. This works because if you have a differential form that's an S form, it takes S entries, and you plug the xi into the first one, the remaining s minus 1 form is still completely anti-symmetric in the remaining ones, because the whole thing used to be totally anti-symmetric. If you feed one of the, if you fill one of the slots, then the remaining ones are still anti-symmetric. Let us do a little example here. Let's say omega is a 1 form, so it's a cotangent vector, and nu is also a 1 form, so it's a cotangent vector. Then the wedge product of the two is a 2 form. Let's consider that 2 form, gamma. Then we can ask, what is the inner derivation of gamma in the xi direction? Well, it's got to be 1 form. But which 1 form is it? How can we write that? Well, this is the product of 2 forms. We can use the Leibniz rule, or actually anti-Leibniz rule, that the inner derivation obeys. What do we obtain? We obtain that the inner derivation on that gamma is the inner derivation on omega veg nu. But that's the product of 2 entries here. So by the anti-Leibniz rule, we have that this can be evaluated using the product rule, the anti-product rule, anti-Leibniz rule. It's the inner derivation of the first factor that's here, veg, the second factor left alone, the nu is not being modified, plus, and then actually a minus 1, because the degree of nu is 1, is odd, so we actually have a minus 1 here. And then we leave the first factor the same, and the second factor gets internally differentiated. Now, what is that? We know already what the inner derivation of a 1 form is. Because remember, we defined that here. We said that the inner derivation of a 1 form, remember when we defined how the inner derivation works, we explained how it acts on 0 forms. It maps them to 0. And it maps 1 forms into the evaluation, right? So the inner derivation in the xi direction of a 1 form omega is just evaluation of omega on xi. So that's what we can use here now. So we obtain that here we have the inner derivation of omega in the xi direction, as we just saw, that's just omega of xi, which is a number at every point. It's a number times the nu, in principle, which is a 1 form. So here we have a 0 form, a number, and here we have a 1 form. In principle, there could be a wedge product, but remember that the wedge product between a number and a 1 form or a p form is just written without the veg, right? Because this is a number, we can omit the veg here. And then here we get a minus sign And then here we have the evaluation of nu on xi. That's a number again, and then this one form is left over. So this is the difference between two one forms. The whole thing is a one form. Now, let's apply that to a tangent vector. It's a one form, right? It's a one form after all. You see, we started with a two form. Then we did the inner derivation, obtained a one form. And now that one form we can apply to a tangent vector to obtain a number. How do we do that? Well, it's a one form. We plug the xi, the eta, the tangent vector into there, and nu has a port to input a tangent vector, and omega has a port to input a tangent vector, and that's how that works. So we get that the inner derivation of gamma, which is a one form, fed a tangent vector, evaluates to the following number. It's omega of xi unchanged, and then it's nu evaluated on the input eta, minus this number times omega evaluated on the tangent vector eta. So we get this nice antisymmetric form here. We can compare that with the claim of the proposition. The claim of the proposition was that we get from the from a two form, we get a one form through the inner derivation by simply plugging the direction vector xi into the first slot of the two form. So let's see. Here we have the inner derivation of eta, the inner derivation of gamma applied to xi, to a tangent vector eta. Then, what is the inner derivation of omega veg eta evaluated at omega veg nu evaluated at eta? Well, omega veg nu can be spelled out in terms of a tensor product. It's just the anti-symmetrized version of omega and nu. So it's omega tensor nu minus nu tensor omega. So just spelled out what omega veg nu is. And then we apply the inner derivation according to the claim of the proposition. All we need to do is plug, in order to evaluate that, we just have to plug that direction vector into the first tensor factor, into the first slot, right? So if we do that, then we obtain omega evaluated on xi, that's here. Then we have nu evaluated on xi, that's there. And this remaining one form nu here evaluates on eta, that's here. And the remaining one form omega evaluates on eta there. It's the same expression as that. Okay, so we just showed in an explicit example the validity of this proposition, namely that the inner derivation simply takes a S form and plugs the direction vector xi into the first entry. So what are the properties of that inner derivation? You can perform the inner derivation twice, or three times, or four times in a row if you want. How does that work? Well, you take an S form, you do an inner derivation with respect to the direction vector xi1, for example, by simply plugging the xi1 into the first factor of the S form to obtain an S minus 1 form. And then we can do another derivation in another direction with respect to xi2, for example, and we plug the xi2 vector in there, right? So we now go down from an S minus 1 form to an S minus 2 form, and so on. It turns out that the properties of the inner derivations are as follows. First of all, anti-commuting. If you first differentiate in the xi2 direction, then in the xi1 direction, you get a negative as if you did it the other way around. That's kind of obvious because in this way, the xi2 gets into the first slot and the xi1 gets into the second slot, and here's the other way around. But since the form is anti-symmetric, that gives us the negative outcome. And in particular, if we internally differentiate twice with the same in the same direction, well, then we are plugging the same direction vector into the first and the second slot. But because they're anti-symmetric, the output must be 0, which means that I xi squared is 0. Remember that the same was true for the co-boundary operator D. Remember, D, the exterior derivative operator, can also be called the co-boundary operator because it is related, as we will later see, to the fact that the boundary of a boundary is vanishing. And here we have the d after a d is vanishing. And here we have that the internal derivation after the internal derivation is also vanishing. Okay, so remember, when xi is a tangent vector and gamma is a cotangent vector, then the inner derivation of the cotangent vector in the direction of the tangent vector is simply the evaluation. That was part of the definition of what the interior, what the inner derivation does. And there's a definition which is motivated by the fact that evaluating gamma on xi is evaluating a cotangent vector on a tangent vector. So this is sometimes also called an inner product, where you have a tangent vector and a cotangent vector. And similarly, the inner derivation is also sometimes called the interior product. So you take a differential form, and you take a tangent vector, and the inner product is what is meant also by inner derivation. Same thing. It's simply the action of plugging a tangent vector into one of the openings of a covariant tensor. That's why it's also called the inner product. But in this course, I will always call it the inner derivation, not the inner product. Because I find that the inner product is a bit confusing here, because it sounds like linear algebra, where it has a slightly different meaning.
So, but for inner product, don't you need a metric to raise that?
Exactly. That's why I don't want to use that term. Because ordinarily, in linear algebra, to define an inner product, we would actually have a metric. But here we don't. This is just evaluation of cotangent vector on tangent vector. If you want to have an inner product, normally, you would have a tangent vector with a tangent vector. Right? You need a metric for that. So I find that this, I just wanted to warn you that the terminology is out there. And that's what they mean. They just mean the inner derivation. They don't mean a metric. Because we haven't introduced a metric just yet. OK, so now we have all the tools. We have the exterior derivative from the previous lecture. We have the inner derivation. And now, as promised, we will combine them in order to obtain a directional derivative. So remember, the xi, the tangent vectors, map functions into functions. Namely, they map a function into the value that the directional derivative has at the point. Now, how can we generalize the notion of directional derivative so that xi can act not only on functions, but also on all differential forms? And these two tools we have available, the exterior derivative, which is an antiderivation of degree k equal to plus 1. And it maps zero forms into one forms through the d. It maps functions into their differentials. And we have generalized that to all of the Grassmann algebra. And then we have the inner derivation, which generalizes the notion of plugging vectors into covariant indices, into cotangent vectors or covariant tensors in general, into differential forms, therefore. And now we will combine the two to obtain what is called the lead derivative, or the lead derivation. And let me give you a spoiler already. It will be this. It's a very simple formula. It's Cartan's formula. It says that the lead derivation is obtained by taking the exterior derivative followed by the inner, plus the inner derivation followed by the exterior derivation. And in total, this thing will be derivation of degree k equal to 0. We can already verify that because d lifts the degree of a differential form by 1, but I reduces it by 1, right? And here, this will reduce it by 1, and that will be lifting it by 1. And we combine the two things in the following way. D is the derivative. It actually could be written in terms of deltas and epsilons and Newton-Leibniz limit. D is a derivative, but it doesn't have a sense of direction to it. Right? D itself doesn't have a sense of direction to it, and we fix that by using then the inner derivation to put a sense of direction into it, namely a choice of direction vector xi. And here we do first the differentiation and then choose the direction in which to differentiate, and here we have first we define the direction and then we do the exterior derivation. We will come to appreciate the simplicity of this formula later when we see how it looks if we try to do that with deltas and epsilons, or with Newton-Leibniz limit, I should say. Okay, so before we motivate that properly, I mean quantitatively, let's motivate it a bit more intuitively. What do we want the Lie derivative to do? Well, it should be a directional derivative. And as such, it should be a derivation. It should be very intuitive. And that means there shouldn't be any funny minus signs in the product rule. It should be a proper derivation, not an antiderivation. So what we want is that the Lie derivative should have the property that if you apply it to the wedge product of two differential forms, then it should be the Lie derivative of the first wedge, the second, plus the first differential form wedge, the Lie derivative of the second. And we're going to achieve this, that it is a proper derivation, not an antiderivation, by the fact that both of these guys are antiderivations, and that will make this combination a derivation. Also, the Lie derivative should map R forms into R forms. The directional derivative of a vector should be a vector. The directional derivative of a function should be a function. The directional derivative of an RS tensor, or actually a differential form, of a differential R form should be a differential R form. So it should be of degree k equal to 0. And as we already discussed, that's going to be achieved by this, because d is lifting the degree, I is lowering it. So what should it do on functions? And what should it do on a basis of the cotangent space? Because remember, once we define that, it's defined everywhere by linearity and the Leibniz rule. So on functions f, the Lie derivative should be the ordinary directional derivative that we already have. So the Lie derivative acting on a function, so an element of lambda 0, should give us a function again, or if you evaluate it at a point, it should give us a number. And what should it be? The Lie derivative in the xi direction of a function should be, well, the tangent vector applied to that function, because the tangent vector is a directional derivative, right? Remember that the tangent vector xi is the sum over coefficient functions times d by dxi. These are the basis vectors that we usually choose in the tangent space. And then this directional derivative is applied to f. So the Lie derivative is just the ordinary directional derivative when applied to functions, to scalar functions. And then remember, now we've defined it on functions. Next, we need to define it on a basis of the cotangent space. For that, we will define how the directional derivative, how the Lie derivative, acts on differential forms of this form, on gradients. Remember that if f is a function, df is a gradient. A gradient is a cotangent vector. And this, if we can explain, if once we've chosen how the Lie derivative acts on these guys, on the gradients, we have implicitly also chosen how it acts on these particular gradients, the dxi, the differentials of the coordinate functions, and we know that those form a basis. So it's sufficient to specify how the Lie derivative acts on these gradients, because that amounts to specifying how the Lie derivative acts on these basis vectors, and then by linearity and the Leibniz rule, we can infer how the Lie derivative acts on all differential forms of arbitrary degree. So how shall it act? How shall the Lie derivative act on gradients, on df? And here the idea is that we make it as simple as possible. And the simplest choice we can make is that it should not matter whether we first directionally differentiate and then take the exterior derivative, or we first take the exterior derivative and then directionally differentiate. So the Lie derivative is mapping one forms into one forms. The Lie derivative is mapping, in particular, gradients into the directional derivative of the gradient. So here, df is a gradient. And the directional derivative of the gradient in the xi direction we want to be the same as if we had first directionally differentiated. So we take psi of f first, and then we do the exterior derivative, right? So this statement is to say that first directionally differentiating and then externally differentiating, by definition, we want to be the same as first externally differentiating and then taking the directional derivative. This is automatically a definition for how the Lie derivative acts on gradients. Namely, in this way. We know how to evaluate that. It's just to evaluate psi on f that gives you a function. That's a zero form. Because it's a tangent vector. Psi f is a function, right? F is a function. Psi f is a one form. D of that one form is a two form, right? So this is a two form that we can calculate. F is a function. Psi of f is a directional derivative. That's a one form what we get here, right? So this is a one form, right? This is a function, and that is a one form. And the directional derivative of this one form is also one form. So that's the definition of how to do that. We know how to evaluate this. And that defines what the Lie derivative is on the gradients. This includes, in particular, the case where we choose for f the coordinate functions xi. So therefore, we now know how to evaluate the Lie derivative on a basis of the cotangent space, namely on the dxi's. And therefore, by linearity and Leibniz rule, we know how it acts on the entire Grassmann algebra. So now that xi is a fully, now that the Lie derivative in the direction of xi is a fully defined derivation, because we've defined it on 0 and 1 forms, so it's defined everywhere. Can we relate it to the exterior derivative and the inner derivation as we claimed? Remember in the spoiler, I said that the Lie derivative, the Lie derivation, can be written in this form. Well, we've already defined it on how it acts on 0 and 1 forms, so it's already fully defined. So let's check whether that's the same as defining the Lie derivation this way. And for that, we have to check that this definition of the Lie derivation does the same thing on 0 forms and on 1 form. So let's check that it does the same thing on 0 forms as what we defined up here. So we take the Lie derivative and act with it on a 0 form. By this definition, it is d after the external after the inner derivation applied to f plus inner derivation after the exterior derivation of f. Now, the inner derivation of a function in the direction of xi is 0. Do you remember why that is? It's because an inner derivation lowers the degree. But if what you inner differentiate is already a 0 form, it can't go to minus 1 forms, right? So by definition, that's 0. OK, so we're just left with the inner derivation of this one form in the xi direction. But if you remember, that's just the evaluation of xi on f. That's that. And that's the definition that we also used up there. We had, because we said that the Lie derivative should act on functions like the ordinary directional derivative, namely the tangent vector is a directional derivative on functions. So it's just that. So that agrees. Now let's apply the Lie derivation on cotangent vectors, in particular on gradients, which includes the basis, of course, because it includes the dxi's. So let's apply the Lie derivative according to this definition on gradients. Then we have exterior after interior derivation on the df plus interior after the exterior derivation on df. Now here we see that we get a d squared. But d squared is 0, so that term is absent. And then what we have here is the following: exterior derivative after inner derivation acting on df. Now, inner derivation acting on df, that's just psi of f again, right? It's just the evaluation of psi on f, and then it's the exterior derivation on that, and that is what we still have up here. So we conclude that this definition of the Lie derivation agrees with the definition up there of the Lie derivation on zero forms and one forms, and therefore by linearity in the Leibniz rule, it agrees everywhere. So the Lie derivation could be defined right away in this way. In principle, we would still have to complete this story. We would still have to prove that it is indeed an antiderivation of degree k equal to 0, that it is a derivation of degree k equal to 0. Yeah?
Can I ask a question?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I wanted to see, Lenina, about how you would motivate the reason you need the second term. Because in our cases, the first term just gave us 0. So it's like, it looks like we don't need the first term.
Good question, but you see, here the first term drops out, and here the second term drops out.
Oh, yeah.
You see? So here we needed the second, here we needed the first.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You're right. Otherwise, yes. Yeah. Okay. Now, definition, the commutator. I'm sure you've seen that in quantum mechanics a lot of times. We can apply this definition to any linear map. And in particular, to any linear map that maps differential forms into differential forms. So if A and B are maps that map differential forms into differential forms, such as a derivation, for example, then we can consider their commutator. So examples of such maps are D and the exterior, the inner derivation, and the Lie derivation. And we can ask, do they commute? Or do they not commute? If they don't commute, what's on the right-hand side? And here are the most important of their properties. One can prove that the Lie derivation, that is to say the directional derivation and the external derivation, commute. Remember, we built that into it, right? When we defined how the Lie derivation acts on one forms, on cotangent vectors, we said, let's require that. And then everything else followed from it. So that's built into it. But then we can also consider the commutator of two directional derivatives. And it turns out that the commutator of two directional derivatives is the directional derivative in the direction of the commutator of those two vector fields. And the commutator of a Lie derivative, that is to say a directional derivative, and an inner derivation is the inner derivation in the direction of the commutator of two vector fields. Now, there's a lot to be said about this. First of all, what the heck is a commutator between vector fields? Okay, let's see how that plays out. Let's just straightforwardly write it out. The commutator of two vector fields, psi, comma, eta, acting on a function. What is that? Well, here we have the first term is psi eta, right? So we apply eta on the function, gives us a directional derivative value, which over the manifold is a function. And we can apply to that the psi directional derivative, and then minus the other way around. And what that actually is the following. The eta is a direction vector, right? It's a tangent vector. So the eta is given by a sum over coefficients eta, and then d by dxj, eta j d by dxj, that's a directional derivative in a direction of the coefficient vector eta. And then psi, it also has an expression like this, minus the other way around, right? And the interesting thing here is this, that this derivative here is differentiating not only the f, this derivative is also differentiating the eta. Right? Because eta is, in general, dependent on where you are in the manifold. The vector field doesn't have to be constant. So what that means is that when you evaluate the commutator of two vector fields, two direction vector fields, then what you get is that this derivative acts on that derivative of f, yielding a second derivative of f, right? But you also have that this derivative differentiates the eta. And over here, we have that this derivative, by the Leibniz rule, of course, also differentiates the derivative of f, but it also differentiates this coefficient function psi, because the psi field may not be constant. In fact, when the when this derivative acts on that derivative, you get a second derivative of f. And here, when this derivative acts on that derivative, you get a second derivative of f. And since second derivatives are symmetric, right, it doesn't matter whether you first differentiate with respect to d by dxi or d by dxj. And since there's a minus sign, all those terms with the second derivatives drop out. They don't survive. The only terms that survive are the terms where you differentiate the coefficient functions eta and psi. So the commutator between two vector fields is actually this. All right? It's a vector field, all right, because you have this derivative on f, but not the second derivative, only first derivative, and these are the coefficient functions. So what that means is that there is something non-trivial going on with the Lie derivative. When you have a Lie derivative, just like the ordinary, you see, the Lie derivative is the extension of the tangent vector field, of the action of the tangent vector field to all differential forms, to all differential forms. And what we saw here is that on functions, on zero forms, we saw the reason why vector fields are not commutative in general. The reason why vector fields are not commutative has nothing to do with the function on which they act. The reason why two vector fields may not be commutative, two tangent vector fields, two direction derivative vector fields, may not be commutative is that these fields themselves are not constant. So one field differentiating the other gives you a contribution. And that extends, see, this is the act, this is directionally differentiating in the eta direction, directionally differentiating in the psi direction, applied to just zero forms. Here, we have the same expression, but generalized to all differential forms, not just zero forms, because the Lie derivation is the generalization of psi, right? Psi just is the directional derivative on zero forms. The Lie derivative is the directional derivative on any forms. And what we see is that, again, the Lie derivatives do not commute in general. Instead, we have that stuff on the right-hand side. This is important to keep in mind later on, because later on we will also have other directional derivatives which take into account the shape of the manifold. And those directional derivatives, the covariant, so-called covariant derivatives, will not commute. And the reason why they don't commute is a different one. The reason why they don't commute is that there is curvature, right? And so parallel transport doesn't commute on a curved manifold. The Lie derivative also doesn't commute, but it knows nothing about curvature. It doesn't commute because the vector fields along which we differentiate can be non-constant. And therefore, if you apply one vector field on the other vector field, it picks up on its variability. Nothing to do with metric, nothing to do with shape, and so on. It's just a property of the non-constancy of the vector fields that we get that. Yeah. That's right. Mathematically, you could have that your functions are not well behaved enough so that those second derivatives do not commute. But we assume in physics that they are always continuously differentiable, and then we have that. I mean, sufficiently many times so that we have that property. Yeah, it might be interesting to see if there is a physics circumstance where it matters. Yeah. Okay, so since the Lie derivative is the directional derivative on on the algebra of differentiable forms, we can now ask, well, can we also use the Lie derivative to differentiate not only differential forms, but any tensor field? Remember that differential forms are a special case of tensor fields, namely purely covariant ones that have been completely anti-symmetrized. What about other tensor fields? That's important because, for example, in physics, we have the energy momentum tensor, and we may want to directionally differentiate it. This will be important to obtain conservation laws of energy, momentum, and so on. But the energy momentum tensor is not anti-symmetric. We can lower its indices to make it covariant, but it's not anti-symmetric. So we would like to have a generalization of the Lie derivative to all tensor fields. How can we do that? Well, let's redefine the Lie derivative so that it does that. But now let's take the approach of Newton-Leibniz, just for illustration, to see how good it is to work with derivations instead. OK, so let's go from first principles. Remember, the Newton-Leibniz limit works this way, that if you want to differentiate a function, you take the limit for epsilon going to 0 of the function at a particular point. That is what you subtract that from the function at a shifted point, divide that by the distance, let the distance go to 0. And that limit defines for you then what the derivative is. So what we now need is an analog of that, where here we have not just a function, a scalar value function of a point on the real line. No, x will be a point on a manifold. F will be a tensor, a general RS tensor on the manifold. And here we will have a tensor that is at a shifted location, namely shifted in the direction in which we want to differentiate. Right? So we don't evaluate our tensor field at the original point, but at a point further down the line, so to speak, in the direction where the direction vector field points. But then we have to be careful, because the tensor that we get there lives in its tensor space, which is not that tensor space, right? The tangent space to one point is not the same as the tangent space at another point, right? So we will have to find a way to identify those tangent spaces, cotangent spaces, tensor spaces, and then map through that identification that tensor over into the tensor space where this is evaluated. Well, and then take the distance to 0, and that will be the derivative of the tensor. OK, so let's do that. We have all the machinery for this. In fact, this goes back to the very first lecture and the second. So let's do the geometric definition of the Lie derivative. And for that, we will use the geometric definition of what a tangent vector is. Remember, it works this way. If you have an actual path on the manifold that goes through a point P, then the tangent vector can be defined to be a tangent vector can be defined to be an actual tangent vector to a path through that point P on the manifold. So let's say gamma is a path that goes from an interval in the real line into the manifold. So gamma takes in an interval of t values that you can think of as time, for example. So gamma takes in inputs of time values, and it outputs points on the manifold. Gamma of t is a path in the manifold. And then a tangent vector, gamma bar, at the point t naught, where our point p is, where we are interested in tangent vectors, is obtained in this way. We obtain the directional derivative of functions. Right? Remember that a tangent vector is a directional derivative of a function. And in the geometric picture, it arises in the following way. We take the path, gamma of t, plug it into the function. This gives us the output of the function along the path that we are traveling. And then we differentiate that function of t with respect to t and evaluate it at the point t naught, at the time t naught, where gamma goes to that point of the manifold where we are interested in. OK, now, what path should we choose when we have a vector field? So imagine we have a vector field xi We want to differentiate with respect to that vector field psi. Now we can visualize a vector field in this way that we have, so this is the manifold, let's say. And now a vector field might be written something like this, right? So at every point, we have a vector. Every point, I just drew a few of them, right? Now imagine we start here, for example. Then we could imagine a path that goes this way. And it's defined such that at every point, the tangent vector to the path is actually identical to the vector field at that point. See that? So imagine, let's say it's like an electric field or magnetic field or whatever. You could imagine that you describe a path through space such that your tangent, so your velocity vector, is equal to the electric field vector, for example. This path might take you quite around a little bit, right? If this vector field psi is very wild, then you get paths that follow the vector field that are pretty wild paths. So the definition is, for a given vector field psi, a path gamma is called an integral curve of psi if the tangent vector to the path, defined in this way, is equal to the value of our vector field psi evaluated at where we are at the moment on that path. So given a vector field psi, we get a whole family of paths, right? We don't just get one path. We could also start here, right? And then we might get another integral curve to be this, right? And maybe like that. So for every vector field, we get integral curves. There is a theorem from the theory of ordinary differential equations, which says that at least locally, you can always do that to some extent. What that means is that every vector field can also be visualized, if you like, through a flow. So if you draw a vector field, that's one way of drawing a vector field is drawing a lot of arrows. But another way of drawing a vector field is to draw all of its flow lines, all of its integral curves. And then you know that the tangents to these integral curves are the vector field. So you can fill the space with integral curves. OK, so now let's look at those integral curves. And why are they important? Well, because we want to differentiate in the direction of a vector field. Right? We want to differentiate tensor fields in the direction of the vector field psi. And if you want to do that geometrically, what we need to do is we take the Newton-Leibniz limit, where what used to be the epsilon here, so we shift the function a little bit, right? Now we travel a little bit along the integral curve in the direction of the vector field psi. So here's how this looks. If we have the manifold here, and we have a vector field psi, then the vector field psi induces its integral curves. So for example, if these are integral curves, then you can tell what the tangent vectors are at every point of the integral curves. And the tangent vectors are the psi field. Of course, we work the other way around. We start with the psi field, and then we calculate what the integral curves are. Now, those integral curves are interesting because they literally describe a flow. Because we can start, for example, at a point here, and then say, OK, I follow that integral curve for a certain amount of time. So the parameter of the integral curve is, let's say, t. We can think of it as time. And then we say, OK, we follow it for 1 second, or a tenth of a second, or whatever. And what that means is that every point is mapped into another point on the same integral curve. Right? So what this means is that a vector field a tangent vector field, a direction field, therefore, defines integral curves, which means they define such a tangent vector field psi defines a flow on the manifold, and we can choose to follow that flow for a little while, for some amount delta t. And that means that every point on the manifold moves a little bit along the flow defined by the vector field. So given a vector field, you get a flow, and then you can choose to follow that flow. So every point of the manifold gets mapped into another point of the manifold. Except if the vector field vanishes there, then the velocity is there, right? Now we can view this flow as a map from a manifold to a manifold. In fact, the same manifold. You know, just like you can have a map from a vector space into another vector space, you can also have a map from a vector space into the same vector space. And here too, you can have maps from our differentiable manifold into the same differentiable manifold. This is what this flow does. It takes points of the manifold and then maps them into other points on the manifold. Like this point gets mapped into that point. So like this point gets mapped into that point. This is a diffeomorphism, right? And remember this hilariously abstract picture where we had a diffeomorphism from manifold to manifold, and then we saw, and then we have function germs. Here we have an algebra of function germs and there, and then we saw, this map from here to here induces a map from here to there. And then we said, and then the tangent vector spaces are also related, and we get a canonical map from here to there. Canonical means no human choice involved. It's automatic, right? So we automatically get a map from this tangent space to that tangent space. And then we saw, because you can always make it more abstract, we saw that, yes, you can also look at the cotangent space and then see that there's a map from the cotangent space here to the cotangent space over there, right? And in fact, if you have this, if you look at the space of RS tensors here and the space of RS tensors there, there's also an isomorphism between them from here to there, induced just by this diffeomorphism here, which means that the flow on a differentiable manifold is not only mapping points to points, but it's also inducing a map of the function space into the function space, tangent vectors into tangent vector, I mean tangent vector to this point to tangent vector to that point. Cotangent vectors here mapped into cotangent vectors there in an isomorphic way, both ways. And generally tensors. Tensors here are canonically mapped into tensors there. We need that. Because if you remember for the Newton-Leibniz rule, we will have to evaluate the tensor field at two different points. All right, so what I said in words, namely that this diffeomorphism, which is induced by the flow on the manifold, which is induced by the vector field, induces a map, an isomorphism of the space of RS tensors at P to the space of RS tensors, R-fold contravariant, S-fold covariant tensors at this point. And that map might be called phi star of t. It's neither a pullback nor a push forward. It's both. Because an RS tensor has both covariant and contravariant parts, right? And they transform differently. It's both. Okay, so we have this canonical map of tensors at one point to tensors at the other point that you arrive at by the flow. Now, what is a tensor field tau? A tensor field is a field that lives on the manifold and gives you, for every point, a tensor at that point, right? That's what the tensor field is. Now, let us look at a tensor field tau. Choose tau because it's a tensor field. So, a tau of P is a tensor. At every point in the manifold, you get an RS tensor. That's a tensor field. It's the field that we want to differentiate. We want to differentiate tau in the direction of xi. That's the overall aim here. Now first, let us look at the case where the derivative is vanishing. What do we mean that the derivative is vanishing? What do we mean when we say that a tensor is the same here as it is over there. What could that mean? Well, we say, that's a definition, that the tensor field tau is invariant under the flow induced by the vector field xi, a concept that will be important later for energy conservation on curved space-time. So we say that a tensor field tau is invariant under the flow induced by a vector field xi if this equation is true. Now let's dissect that equation, what exactly that means. So what we do is this. We take a point of the manifold, and then we let it flow by an amount of time t. Phi is that flow, right? Phi t is that flow. So we take a point p, and then it's like here, and it flows over there, and we arrive over there. So for a fixed point, for a fixed amount of time t, we have a map from here to here, which we can also write as a map from here to there. Right? So it's a finite amount of time that the flow has happened. Our point p flowed to a new point, which is this point here, phi t of p. And then we evaluate the tensor field there. We say, OK, what is the value of our tensor field tau there? What's the actual tensor there? OK, let's keep that in mind. That is the value of the tensor field over here, or over here, right? And on the left-hand side, what do? Here we take the point p of the manifold, and then we check immediately, what's the value of the tensor field at p? What's the value of the tensor field here? And then we use this combined push-forward-pullback map, which is induced between the tensor spaces, right? We use that to map the tensor at the point p into a tensor at that point over here. So we take the value of the tensor here, use this canonical map, and see what its image is over there. And then we compare the two. So you see, we can either first evaluate the point, evaluate the tensor field at this point, get a tensor, and then use the canonical isomorphism between this tensor space and that tensor space to map it over here. Or alternatively, we can simply jump from this point to that point and then evaluate the tensor field there. In principle, there's no reason that those two tensors that we get by the one or the other procedure have anything to do with another, because the tensor field is free to vary whichever way it wants. But if the two tensors are the same, then we say that we have an invariance. And of course, for the purpose of differentiation, we want to take the difference between those two tensors and in the limit where the flow is infinitesimal in the Newton-Leibniz spirit. At this point, we start to appreciate how easy the algebraic approach is, right? Because you don't have to do any of this.
You don't need to draw anything.
Yeah, and you don't need to draw anything, that's right. But, you know, on the other hand, this really provides some intuition, right? So that we know what the heck it is that this lead derivation actually does. So, definition then. The lead derivative of a tensor field tau at the point p with respect to the flow induced by the vector field xi is defined in this way. This is a compact way of writing it, and here is the slightly more detailed way of writing it. Let me explain. So the lead derivative of the tensor field tau at the point p in the direction of the vector field xi is obtained by doing the following. We take the value of the tensor field at the point p. So this is analog to saying, you see, f prime of x is equal to limit epsilon, or let's just say t going to 0. Epsilon going to 0. And then we have here f of x plus epsilon minus f of x divided by epsilon, right? So what we have here is the analog formula for that. We have the limit for t going to 0. So for doing a flow that's infinitesimally small, then the 1 over t is like the 1 over epsilon over here. And then the tau of p is the same as the f of x. Here we simply evaluate the function at the point where we want to know the derivative. This is the value of the function at the shifted point. That is the value of our function, in this case a tensor field, evaluated at the other point. Here it was trivial to take the difference between the two because that's a number, that's a number. But in our case over here, this is a tensor in one tensor space, and that's a tensor in another tensor space. So we have to map it first into the same tensor space. So what we have here is a tensor at the point P, and here what do we have? We take the point that the point P flows into at time t. So gamma of t is down the flow from P in the direction of xi. So that's the point that we flowed to in the amount of time t. Then we evaluate the tensor at that point. But this tensor lives in a different tensor space than that, so we can't subtract them. So what we have to do then is to say, OK, this is a tensor at that far away point. And then we use this canonical push-forward-pull-back map for tensors to map it into a tensor in the same tensor space as that one, namely the tensor space at the point P. Then we can subtract them and divide by the amount of time that has passed and take t to 0. OK, so that's the Newton-Leibniz limit there. And we can do all of that explicitly also in a chart. What do we obtain? Well, the flow is described in the following way. A point with coordinate x flows to a point with coordinates x tilde. And the x tilde coordinates are the same as the original coordinates x plus a little bit of flow, namely t times the direction vector, right? We flow in the direction of xi by the amount of time t. So therefore, the coordinates of the new point are the coordinates of the old point plus direction vector times t. Of course, that's just a straight line. But for differentiation, we only need the linear approximation. And then plus higher order terms, which would be much more complicated. But we don't care about them because they will drop out when it comes to the calculation of the Newton-Leibniz limit. This one, right? Because if you have a term that's proportional to t, it will contribute. Because you have t over t. But if you have a term that's proportional to t squared, then you have t squared divided by t, still proportional to t, drops out as t goes to 0. So we don't care about the t squared terms. Then we have the Jacobian matrix. You see, this map here is a change of coordinates map, right? We take a tensor, and then as we map the tensor from one tensor space to another, as we change coordinates, therefore, we have these transformation rules, as we discussed, for the contravariant and for the covariant components of the tensor. And the Jacobian matrix that does it is what? It's dx tilde by dx. And in this case, where the x tildes are simply affine connected, affinely related to the axis, so it's just the same plus a direction vector, we can evaluate that derivative very easily, right? Dx tilde I by dxj gives us the Kronecker delta from differentiating this with respect to xj. And then we also get the derivatives of the direction vector field. Derivative of the direction vector field, remember that? We had that two direction vector fields don't commute in their action because direction vector fields can change over time. They can, no, not over time, but direction vector fields can change over the manifold, right? And here, too, we have a sensitivity to the change in the direction field. Here we get the dxi by dx. OK, so we get this Jacobian matrix. And then we can also calculate the inverse one. We need that because we need a Jacobian matrix for the contravariate and the inverse Jacobian matrix for the covariant indices. And the inverse matrix is this. You might think, what really? The inverse of this matrix, you see it has two indices, I and J, it's a matrix. The inverse is that? Is it as simple as this? Not really. But it is up to corrections of order t squared. So that's good enough. If you just multiply that with this, you find, yeah, it's actually this, because the mixed terms drop out, right? Because of the plus and the minus. And then you get higher order terms proportional to t squared, but they drop out in the Newton-Leibniz limit. All right, so then the image of the tensor, tau at x tilde, under the flow, backwards, you see, backwards to the original tensor space, has these components. This expression here is in coordinates. What that is, it is given by the tensor at the faraway point. I mean, not that far away, but the away point. And then we have these transformation rules, which is playing out what this phi star inverse does. And we can spell out what these things are, right? Because we have these Jacobian and inverse Jacobian matrices. They are those. So we can spell this out. And we get all of these factors here with Kronecker delta minus t something, and also Kronecker deltas with plus t something. And how many of each depends on how many contravariant and how many covariant indices our tensor has. Right. And then, so we arrive at this expression here. But then we still have the tensor evaluated at the faraway point. Now, in order to evaluate the tensor field at the faraway point, we can use a Taylor expansion, which we carry to first order in T again. Right? So now we different, in order to Taylor expand that, what do we get? We get this tensor simply evaluated at x, right? That's this term. But then we also get this tensor differentiated in the direction of d by dxi. And then, how did that happen? That's weird. Anyway, so Taylor expansion means that, right. So it's a Taylor expansion of this directional derivative, right? And what we get is, this tensor evaluated at x, that's this, plus directional derivative of this tensor in the direction of xi. And that's this term here. It is the derivative of our tensor field in the k direction. Oh, I didn't say that yet. I wanted to say it here, right? So you can imagine that if we wanted to fully spell all of this out, we would have to use a lot of summation symbols. A lot of summation symbols there. And Einstein was fed up with writing so many summation symbols, so he introduced the notation that, and you probably know that, that whenever you have an upper and a lower index, they are supposed to be summed over anyway. If you have an upper and a lower index with the same label, then you know that you have to sum over them, so you just leave out the sum. So we use this Einstein summation in this index notation. And also, we use the modern differential geometric notation, which doesn't write d by dx kf anymore, but instead we just write f, comma k, means differentiate in the k direction. OK, so the Taylor expansion then of the directional derivative of our tensor gives us the tensor at x plus directional derivative of it in the xi direction. Right? So we differentiate in the xk direction, and then contracted with xik, and then plus and minus these terms that we already had over here. And what's going on here is that we get from this, we get a term that doesn't contain t, that's this one, and another term that does contain t. And here we always have a constant term and a term that contains t. So overall, this will give us also quadratic terms in T, and those we neglect, of course. And here is spelled out what you get when you neglect the T squared terms. OK, so what we have written down here is this business. So now we, in order to obtain the lead derivation, we take this, which is all of this, and subtract tau of p from it, which is this first term. And then we divide by 1 over t, and let t go to 0. That's the lead derivation. And what we obtain then is this expression here. I mean, this is just the abstract expression here. And then we fill in what we calculated over there. And what we see is that two things are going on. The lead derivative of the tensor field tau has a term that's very intuitive, namely differentiating that tensor-valued functions, a function with respect to xk, and then contracting with the direction vector xi. One might think this is all we need for the directional derivative. But no, we get all of that other stuff too. And this other stuff is not concerned with differentiating tau at all. It's not differentiating the taus. Instead, it's differentiating the xi. So what we see is that the lead derivative is automatically sensitive not only to the variability of tau, it's also sensitive to the variability of xi itself. Okay, because as you directionally differentiate in a particular direction, the thing is that the vector field in whose direction you differentiate also changes its direction. And this thing catches on itself, and that's why we get these extra terms. At this point, we can ask, all right, we did it the hard way with the Newton-Leibniz limit. Is this equivalent to the definition of, to the algebraic definition of the lead derivation? Yes, it is equivalent because we can check that the action on zero forms and one forms is the same. So it's equivalent on differential forms. And here's the proof. Yeah, we are out of time. So here's the proof, and I will not discuss it. You can check that it's straightforward, that it agrees on zero forms and on one forms, that is, on functions in lambda naught and on cotangent vector fields. And therefore, yes, it agrees on all differential forms. But this definition is more general. Right? Because you can apply this to all tensors, not just totally anti-symmetric ones. So that's an advantage of this. But here are some properties. And the last one will be interesting. First of all, the lead derivative maps RS tensors into RS tensors by design. And the lead derivative of a vector field is the commutator of the two vector fields. It's actually the same thing, how they catch onto themselves. Right? The variability of the vector fields themselves leads to non-trivial derivatives. And one also finds that the lead derivative in the direction of xi plus eta is the lead derivative in the direction of xi plus the lead derivative in the direction of eta. So if we have linearity in this way. And then we have that the lead derivative in the direction of a commutator of two vector fields is the commutator of the lead derivatives in the two directions. And then finally, we can ask, did we really have to do that with the Newton-Leibniz limit? And it turns out we really didn't. No, you can even do that one, the more general lead derivative. You could do that also algebraically. Because it turns out that the lead derivative acting on tensors, so not just differential forms, but tensors, namely tau tensor sigma, obeys a Leibniz rule. And that, again, is a defining property of it. Right? So we could have also operated this way, that we say we want to define a derivation on the algebra of tensors, whose multiplication is not the wedge product, but just the tensor product, and then would have also obtained the lead derivative. But it was probably worth showing how it actually plays out when you do this with the Newton-Leibniz limit, and then all of these canonical identifications of tensor spaces and all that. OK, that's as far as we got today. Any questions?
So that's the derivation of the Grassmann algebra, which we can generalize this way to all tensors? I mean, the inner derivative and the tensorial derivative, we cannot generalize that.
No, that's right. They only apply to the differential forms. The lead derivative is the one that does, yes. we will get some more derivations that we can apply to both. So for example, the covariant differentiation, we can apply to differential forms, but we can also apply it to tensors in general. Okay, more questions? All right then, see you next week.